everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week we're very pleased to have Matthew Goodman on the show, and we'll be talking about his terrific new book, The Sun and the Moon, The Remarkable True Account of Hoaxers, Showmen, Dueling Journalists, and Lunar Man-Bats in 19th Century New York. That is quite a subtitle, and it is quite a book. In this book, you will meet rogues and ne'er-do-wells and Edgar Allan Poe and P.T. Barnum and some man-bats and street urchins and ink-stained printers, people eating a lot of oysters, a famous astronomer, and you'll have a rollicking good time, I guarantee you. This is a book that tells a terrific story of the invention of the modern newspaper in the 1830s in New York. And when I say the modern newspaper, I mean something like the Weekly World News plus the New York Times plus I don't know what. It really will introduce you to a New York and a world of journalism that I had really never encountered. All that and in wonderfully colorful prose brought to you by Matthew Goodman. I enjoyed talking to Matthew today, and I hope that you enjoy the interview. Here it is. Hi, Matthew.
How you doing, Marshall?
I'm very well. How are you today?
Doing okay.
You're in Brooklyn, is that correct?
Snowy Brooklyn, yes.
That's right. Is it cold there?
It is freezing, and we've got what for us these days is a blizzard, which is about 4 inches of snow.
Yeah, we have a little bit more snow than that, and as I was just telling somebody else, that what you just described as cold is not cold. When I rode my bike in this morning, it was minus 23 degrees. No wind chill.
I think it's about positive 23 here.
Yeah, so. No, minus 23 degrees. I was like, oh, my God, you die out here. So anyway, I should tell our listeners that we have Matthew Goodman on the show today, and we'll be talking about his book, The Sun and the Moon, The Remarkable True Account of Hoaxers, Showmen, Dueling Journalists, and Lunar Man-Bats in 19th Century New York. I have to say that when I read Lunar Man-Bats, I was hooked on the book. I mean, anytime you...
That's the phrase that gets everybody.
Yeah, I mean, you listen to that, and because it reminds everybody of Bat Boy, right? I mean, it's...
I think so, yeah. That hadn't actually been my intention, but I think a lot of people sort of caught on to that, the Weekly World News.
Yeah, exactly, Bat Boy. That's certainly what I thought of. In any event, it's a terrific book. I've read it. It's a real page-turner, and Matthew has a gift for kind of ringing, evocative prose. He describes a New York that, even though everybody has been in New York, you don't know, actually. I was looking through it, and I was, you know, that the New York you describe of the 1830s, I just didn't really know anything about that. And it was an enormous city of 250,000 people. Is that right?
That's right. It was just over 250,000 people. Yeah. But, you know, that made it the biggest city in the country at that point. Actually, the biggest city in the continent.
Yeah. It's funny because I grew up in Wichita, Kansas, which has a little over 200,000 people, and we always
really so there you go.
Yeah.
It's the biggest small town in America.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it. It's absolutely amazing. So, anyway, why don't we begin by having you tell us a little bit about yourself. Tell us about your background and kind of where you were born and grew up, that kind of thing. Anything you're comfortable talking about.
Sure. Well, let's see. You know, as you mentioned, I live in Brooklyn, New York, and my kids are fifth generation Brooklynites.
Wow.
So we go way back in New York. I was born and raised in the city and the environs of the city, and really am sort of ever fascinated by the history of this place, but you know, both the present and the history of this place. So that was part of what made this book such an exciting venture for me, mm-hmm. to sort of delve into the history and describe, as you mentioned, this sort of unknown New York, the New York of the 1830s, which had not been written about very much in other books. So let's see, I've been writing for a long, long time. You know, I don't know if I actually consider myself a historian. I'm certainly not a, you know, a licensed historian, you know, like a licensed plumber or something.
My license right here on the wall in my office.
Because, you know, my training is really in creative writing. You know, I have an advanced degree in creative writing as opposed to history, but it happens that history is something that I've always been extremely interested in, and mm-hmm. a lot of my undergraduate work was in American history.
Mm-hmm.
And but I was also always extremely interested in writing. It was something that I've wanted to do ever since I was very, very young. I wanted to be a writer, you know, from the age of like six or mm-hmm. seven or something like mm-hmm. that. And so, you know, after college, I got into creative writing and doing fiction writing mm-hmm. and spent a long time doing fiction, you know, writing short stories and so forth. Mm-hmm. But even those stories were pretty historically based. Mm-hmm. There was always a lot of research that went into those stories, mm-hmm. You know, sometimes to the exclusion of actually writing the stories. I was just so fascinated by, you know, by the research. And, you know, I eventually got into doing nonfiction writing because of that interest in history. And I did food writing for a long time. I wrote a weekly, actually a biweekly column for a Jewish newspaper called The Forward, mm-hmm. where I was the food columnist and, wrote, you know, countless columns about, the history of Jewish food around mm-hmm. the world and describing the cuisines of various Jewish communities all mm-hmm. around the world mm-hmm. and the history of cool. various ingredients and dishes and so forth. And that was really kind of a window. Food was really kind of a window for me to explore my interest in history and culture. And some years back, I guess in 2005, I put a lot of that writing together with a lot of the recipes that I had accumulated over the years and put out a cookbook, which was my first book, and that was published by HarperCollins, called Jewish Food, The World at Table, which was about half writing and half recipes, mm-hmm. and recipes from about 30 different communities around the world.
Wow, that must have been fascinating to research.
It was really fascinating. You know, I was able to travel, you know, a good deal around the world to visit some of these communities that still exist. Unfortunately, many of these communities don't really yeah. exist anymore and exist only in the memories of the descendants yeah. of these communities. But, you know, fortunately, I was living in New York and a lot of them mm-hmm. live here. And really some of my best times was when I would get invited, you know, to the Syrian great-grandmother's house, you know, and she would, right. you know, teach me how to make various dishes and describe to me the history of them and so right. forth. Okay. So when that book came out, I thought, oh, well, I'm pretty much done with food writing at this point. I've pretty much said everything that I have to say in the area of food and looking around for another topic. And I knew I wanted to write something about the history of New York because it was something, you know, that I mentioned I'm just so interested in. And I was, you know, spent a long time kind of looking around for a topic that both engaged my interest and also was something that hadn't been, you know, written about. And, of course, you know, the history of New York City has been plumbed by so many people before mm-hmm. me. It's hard to find topics that, you know, haven't been covered numerous times. Mm-hmm. And I got to the point where I was actually just reading the Encyclopedia of New York History, you know, that great magisterial volume that mm-hmm. Kenneth Jackson oversaw. And I happened across an entry that just said moon hoax in quotation marks. And there was this little paragraph describing this moon hoax from 1835. And I thought, my God, what the hell is that? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it told this incredible story. And then I went down to, at the end of each of these entries, they have a kind of a bibliographic line that gives the books that the person who wrote that entry got their information from. And lo and behold, there was no bibliographic line at the end of this entry. And I thought, my God, has nobody written a book about this topic? Mm-hmm. So, of course, mm-hmm. I did what every 21st century historian does. You know, I went to Google. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Amazon.com, and no one actually had written anything mm-hmm. about this topic. And I said, well, that's my topic.
Yeah, no, it's a good one. It's definitely a good one. I should say that if we could just talk for a little bit about the literary life. I mean, I know that I have a lot of friends who are writers, and I have students that want to be writers. The University of Iowa has a big writing program and so on and so forth. but actually, you know, making a life of it and a career of it is almost as much of a, well, it's really a kind of craft. And I'd be interested if you would talk to us a little bit about how you, you know, made a career as a writer.
That's a great question, Marshall. It really is. And, you know, it's something that I never get asked about, but it's such an important topic. I mean, I've been, you know, working as a writer for probably close to 20 years now. Mm-hmm. But for a long time, and especially when I was writing fiction, you know, I kind of had to cobble together a life, had to cobble together a living in the way that I could, you know, and basically I did a lot of, you know, sort of hack work. You know, I don't mean to demean it by calling it hack work, but it wasn't the work I would have chosen to do if I had my choice. You know, I did things like, you know, I wrote book jacket copy for the MIT Press for many years. Mm-hmm. I wrote, you know, ad copy. I wrote textbooks for kids. Mm-hmm. For various educational publishers, and basically kept myself afloat for a long, long time, you know, as I was trying to kind of make my way as a writer. And it really wasn't until this cookbook that I finally was able to support myself solely on my creative work. You know, I got a pretty decent-sized advance. Mm-hmm. That cookbook, and it really kind of opened my eyes. All mm-hmm. of a sudden, I said, "My God, I actually can support myself mm-hmm. through books." Mm-hmm. And after that book came out, and you know, I hit upon this Moon Hoax book, and Basic again was very supportive. Basic Books is the publisher, mm-hmm. and they gave me a, you know, again a decent sized advance. You know, not the kind of thing that one gets rich on, but mm-hmm. enough to support the research mm-hmm. and the writing of the book. Mm-hmm. And so now, you know, I support myself and help to support my family mm-hmm. by means of writing books, mm-hmm. which I feel very privileged to be able to do mm-hmm. because there aren't that many people who are able to do that. Mm-hmm. And so at this point, you know, when I'm looking for new book projects, they have to meet some rigorous standards. You know, they have to be both intellectually interesting to me and have some sort of political importance because I'm very interested in that, mm-hmm. And at the same time be commercially saleable, mm-hmm. you know, something that I think is going to be something that a commercial publisher is going to be interested in paying for.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's the struggle.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And if I could just sort of summarize what you've said, and again, I've done a little bit of this myself and have written commercially, so to say, is that there's a long period of time in which you do kind of scut work.
Right.
But it's still writing work. And you know that there's a kind of trick to every genre you can write in, whether it's book jackets or ad copy or whatever it is, and you can actually find a certain amount of fulfillment in doing that. And also, I really like what you said about picking your topics carefully when it comes to books, because I think most people don't realize the position that commercial publishers are in right now. That they really do need books that sell. It can't just be the topic that you love. If you want to write a book about the topic that you love, go to graduate school. That's right.
I mean, you know, or you know, you can get a job as a professor or whatever it is, and then you know you can write about whatever you'd like. I mean, I happen to be very interested. I'm just give you one example. I happen to be very interested in Yiddish.
Yeah.
The Yiddish language is something that I went back to school and studied.
Really? Wow.
And you know, speak to some extent. I read it better than I speak it, and you know, have written about Yiddish and have actually written in Yiddish to some extent in the past. And I'd love to write a book that in some way partook of my interest in Yiddish, and maybe I will someday. But that's a deeply non-commercial book.
Yeah, true.
So, you know, that definitely affects the calculus for me in terms of what projects I choose.
It is, you know, again, you mentioned Yiddish, and I just want to plug a future interview and recommend a book to everyone. I'm going to be interviewing Samuel Kassov, who's a professor at Trinity College, I think. And he wrote a book called Who Will Write Our History, which is the subtitle is Rediscovering the Hidden Archive from the Warsaw Ghetto. And it's about these Yiddish scholars during the Warsaw Ghetto and how they collected historical materials. And they were also big Yiddishists. You know, there was the conflict between Yiddishists and assimilationists and Hebraists. And these people were all big Yiddishists. So we'll be interviewing him in the next couple of weeks, and I'm reading the book now. But one thing I can tell you about the book is it's deeply academic. It's not, it's a great book. It's a fantastic piece of scholarship. And actually the central character in it, a guy named Ringelblum. It would be a fascinating kind of a topic. But the book itself, you know, serves a different function, and it's published by an academic press, Indiana.
Is that Emmanuel Ringelblum by any chance?
I think it is, yeah.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
And he sort of put it together, and he was also very politically active, and he, you know, was active in YIVO and the whole nine yards.
That's right. I used to work at YIVO.
And, oh, did you really?
Yeah, and I wrote a museum catalog about the Bund, which really worked for the Bund.
Sure, yeah.
So again, it's just, you know, that's the kind of job that one does.
Right. But I did also want to kind of piggyback on something you said about kind of how to find your audience here. And I've worked as an editor a little bit, not as a book editor, but you know, sort of, you know, in magazines and things like that. Because one of the things that you remind me of is you can take a historical topic and write fiction around it and be very successful if you're talented. And the two obvious examples in this case would be The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, mm-hmm. by Michael Chabon, and then that other book, what is it called? Everything's Illuminated.
Right.
I mean, these are books that required a lot of historical research to write. I mean, those people had to know.
Right. Well, I've read both of those books, and they're both terrific books.
Yeah.
You can go different ways. You can go different ways with it. I mean, you can write fiction, which has a historical basis, or you can do more like what I was doing in this book, which is to write history using some of the techniques of creative writing or fiction writing to help that history come alive.
Yeah, no, and you do a marvelous job of it. I really think you do. Well, obviously, it's a terrifically written and very extraordinarily entertaining book. It has a kind of cinematic quality. As I'm looking. Hopefully, you'll sell the film rights to it.
From your lips to God's ears.
Exactly. That's good. So why don't we talk a little bit about the book itself? I mean, it is so full of characters that you've heard of doing things that you didn't imagine they could ever do, that I don't even know exactly where to start.
We could start with the hoax itself.
Okay, let's go ahead then. Have at it.
Well, in 1835, the summer of 1835, a newspaper called The Sun, which was the first of the so-called penny papers in New York, the first to kind of challenge the dominance of the old line of expensive merchant papers, The Sun published a series of six articles that claimed that life had been discovered on the moon by way of this powerful new telescope that had supposedly been invented by the eminent British astronomer Sir John Herschel, the hydro-oxygen telescope.
Demonstrating that compound words in Latin always mean you're smart.
Yeah. Exactly. And by means of this telescope, Sir John supposedly had discovered an entire landscape on the moon, you know, that included, you know, poppy fields and waterfalls and mountains and forests and so forth. And then as his telescope continued, you know, along its way, he discovered life of great, you know, increasing degrees of complexity. So, you know, they discovered sheep and hairy bison. And then as the series went along, ever more remarkable creatures. So it turns out that Sir John had discovered unicorns on the moon and biped beavers, beavers that walked on their hind legs and had apparently discovered the secret of fire. They had built huts. You saw smoke coming out of these huts. And then most astonishing of all, the crowning touch of the series were these 4-foot-tall man bats, lunar man bats. Vespertilio Homo, Sir John was supposed to have dubbed them, intelligent creatures that talked and flew and built temples and did art and fornicated in public, apparently. Although the Sun did not go into much detail about that. This was the beginning of the Victorian era. The series caused an absolute sensation in New York. You know, people swarmed around the Sun offices night and day waiting to, get the next installment of the series. And by the time the series had finished its run, The Sun had become the most widely read newspaper in the entire world, not just in the city or in the country, but actually the most widely read newspaper in the world. So it was a sensational event in the history of the city.
Yeah, no, it sounds, well, I know for a fact that it's absolutely amazing. So why don't we talk a little bit about the origins of these newspapers themselves, because I think that most people don't have a very good understanding of what a newspaper was in 1830.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Well, let's see. In the beginning of the 1830s, there were 11 daily newspapers in New York City. There were 7 morning papers and 4 evening papers. But in a city that was over 250,000, they had a combined circulation of only about 26,000, which wasn't very much. They were not meant for the average men and women of the city. They were meant for the elite, for the upper crust, as the phrase was then coming into vogue. They cost 6 cents a copy, which doesn't sound like much to us today, but, you know, in point of fact, it was a good deal of money at the time, more expensive than the artisans of the city could afford. They were meant for the aristocrats, the merchants, and the kinds of articles that they published were the sorts of things that merchants would be interested in, you know, ships launchings and commodity pricing and the international economic situation and so forth. That's the way that newspapers were until in 1833, a young printer named Benjamin Day, who was by no means wealthy, he was a working class guy, decided that he was going to create a new kind of newspaper, really a revolutionary new kind of paper that wasn't going to cost 6 cents, it was only going to cost 1 cent, thus the origin of the phrase penny paper. And it was going to feature the kind of articles that Day thought, correctly as it turned out, most New Yorkers actually wanted to read. So it focused a lot on crime stories. They were really the most popular part of the paper, the crime stories. But, you know, sort of shorter pieces, punchier pieces, much more local interest than the merchant papers had, scandal and gossip, entertainment, sports, really kind of the template for local newspapers today. You know, when we read a good local paper today that has, you know, local coverage and good sports coverage and entertainment and scandal and so forth, the template for that was really set by Benjamin Day back in 1833.
And I guess one thing we should say about the content of these papers is that it was important that it be, I think as Stephen Colbert calls it, important that it be truthy, not exactly true.
Well, that's right. That's right. Some of the stories, you know, seem pretty clearly to be, really fable, almost like fables, really. And I think people understood that. You know, in those days, the whole notion of objective truth or objective journalism that we, you know, look to in our printed newspapers today didn't really develop until later on in the century. Not until really the middle of the century do we have that. You know, at that time, papers were highly partisan. A lot of them had been founded by political parties, were funded by political parties, were, you know, tremendously slanted. And, you know, people understood that and were not expecting to get, you know, the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth from their newspapers. They had a much more ambiguous relationship to the newspaper than people do today. So and that helps to explain somewhat the reaction, the ultimate reaction, when people found out that these moon stories, you know, were not true. They didn't turn away from The Sun as people had expected that they would. They sort of, you know, kept on reading The Sun throughout.
Tell us a little bit about the, I guess it's the editor of The Sun, not the original editor, but I guess the second editor, or was he Richard Adams?
Well, he was the third. Benjamin Day himself was the first editor, mm-hmm. and then there was a guy named George Wisner. And then when Wisner quit in the summer of 1835, Day hired a guy named Richard Adams Locke, who was kind of an itinerant journalist. He was an expatriate British journalist, had come over to New York only 4 years before with his wife and child. You know, not all that much was known about Locke before this book. I did a lot of research. You know, it's a little bit disconcerting for a historian when, you know who your main character is, and he's constantly referred to in the sources as enigmatic. You know, it means that there's not that much known about this guy. And in fact, as I found out, that almost everything that was actually known about him turns out to be not true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was said that he was born in New York. That's not true. He was born in Somerset, England. It was said that he was a direct descendant of the philosopher John Locke. That's not true. He was an indirect descendant. It was said that he had gone to the University of Cambridge. That turns out not to be the case. So, you know, there was a lot of misinformation about this guy. But what is known, what was known about him, was that he was a very erudite guy. He could write extremely well about all sorts of topics. You know, he wrote about history, philosophy, religion, science, and so forth. And in the summer of 1835, he proposed this series Today, in which the Sun claimed that they had were reprinting a series of articles from a Scottish scientific journal, the Edinburgh Journal of Science.
Mm-hmm.
But in point of fact, these articles had been written by none other than Richard Adams Locke himself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, isn't it the case, though, that much of the misinformation about Locke is due to Locke's own creation of his past?
Absolutely. Locke was a fabulist. You know, he was a newspaper fabulist in the sense that, you know, he wrote this, you know, incredibly imaginative series of stories. But yes, a lot of the misinformation about Locke comes straight from the mouth of Locke. Locke was the one who said that he had gone to the University of Cambridge. Locke was the one who said that he was descended from John Locke. Locke was the one who said that his father had served in the Canadian Army, or in the British Army in Canada. All of this, Locke was the one who said that he had been born in New York. So yes, a lot of this information came from Locke himself. He was really a very complicated guy, somebody who I came to have a great deal of sympathy for over the course of my research.
Mm-hmm.
As it turns out, he was a political radical who had actually been forced to leave England as a result of his political activities. He'd been the editor of a local newspaper in Somerset, his home county. But, you know, he was a champion of Catholic emancipation. He was a supporter of the Republican movement, which was trying to democratize the British political system. As a result of this, he got fired from his job. Eventually, he had to leave England entirely and come to New York. While he was at the Sun, he was also a very strong opponent of slavery, of Southern slavery, mm-hmm. which was unusual in New York in the 1830s. It was hard to find an abolitionist in New York in the 1830s. New York was a very Southern sympathetic city, probably the most of all the Northern cities. Its economy was very tied up with the Southern cotton trade. And it was very courageous of Locke to take this stance while at the Sun. He was almost unique among New York newspaper editors for that stance. So he was a political radical. He was also, as it turns out, a great believer in science,
mm-hmm.
in the liberatory power of science, of modern science. and he was a religious free thinker, something of a religious dissident, sympathetic to Unitarianism. And he was very distressed by any attempt by religion to control the free play of science, to have any kind of influence over scientific inquiry. He had, as it turns out, a couple of young geologist friends who had actually given up their research because it was inescapably leading them to the conclusion that the Earth was in fact millions of years old,
mm-hmm.
and not just a few thousand years old, as mm-hmm. the biblical scholars of the time
yeah.
were saying. They gave up their research. Locke found this very disturbing, and he was especially interested in astronomy among the sciences, and he was especially interested, was especially distressed by the religious astronomers of the time, who were probably the most popular of the astronomical writers of the time, you know, men like Thomas Dick, the Scottish astronomer, and so forth, who believed that the moon was inhabited, and not just the moon, but all of the heavenly bodies. The sun was inhabited. John Herschel's father, William Herschel himself, had been the one to first posit that idea of an inhabited sun.
Mm-hmm.
All of the stars, all of the planets, comets, they were all inhabited because God, in his infinite wisdom, would not create these worlds without also creating intelligent beings there to appreciate them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Locke thought this was nonsense, and not just nonsense, but dangerous nonsense, because it was distorting the minds of young scientists.
Mm-hmm.
And so he set out to satirize these ideas.
Yeah,
I was going to say, this is the most fascinating part of the entire narrative, and that is that he didn't intend the story to actually sell copies. Yeah, he intended it.
Right, satire. This is really quite amazing. Go on.
Yeah, well, I think for Benjamin Day, the publisher, he was pretty interested in selling copies.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't think Locke was opposed to selling copies. I mean, he was the editor of the paper. But that wasn't his prime intent. His prime intent was not to write a hoax. His prime intent was to write a satire of these religious astronomers. You know, he basically said, if they believe in an inhabited moon, I will give them an inhabited moon. And if they believe that, you know, the Lunarians are Christians, then I will give them, you know, lunar man bats who build temples on the moon. And I will clothe it all in this kind of high-flown, scientific-sounding language that they themselves use.
Mm-hmm.
And in the process, expose this for the humbug that it is, for the nonsense that it is. But what he had not foreseen was that the public had been so schooled in the ideas of these religious astronomers that when these articles appeared, they simply believed them.
Mm-hmm.
They simply believed the articles. They thought they were true. And then when they found out that they weren't true, they derided them as a hoax, when in point of fact, they were neither true nor a hoax. They were a satire.
Mm-hmm.
And Locke himself was deeply disappointed by the reaction that these articles got. And he described himself to a friend, he confided to a friend that he was, as he put it, the best self-hoaxed man in New York.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But the paper sold like gangbusters, as you said earlier. I mean, they made an absolute fortune for the Sun. Did they attempt to repeat this success with other similar stories?
To some extent, but... you know, Locke himself tried to repeat it later on. This is a somewhat complicated story. He tried another hoax some years later. But by that point, you know, fool me once kind of thing. You know, people were not going to fall quite as much for newspaper hoaxes as they had been this time. But there were newspaper hoaxes that came later over the years. There was a story that came out in the Herald some years later that the animals had all escaped from the New York Zoo.
Mm-hmm.
Edgar Allan Poe, who's another one of the characters in the story, tries his own hoax 9 years later in the pages of the Sun about a balloon trip around the world. But neither of those stories really succeeded. The moon hoax was really the one, was really the hoax that had an impact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, tell us, because there are a couple of other characters that our listeners would have heard about. One of them is Edgar Allan Poe, my relative, I guess.
Is he actually a relative?
I think all the Poes are related. The Poe genealogy is pretty well worked out, and we're not a very savory bunch, I can tell you that. So yeah, I think I'm as crazy as he is. It's just
drunkards and academics.
Well, I live in the era of medication. He didn't. So Edgar Allan Poe is one of them, and then P.T. Barnum. Why don't you begin with Poe and tell us how he fits into your story?
Right. You know, I was amazed once I began to look into the story to find out all these incredible, larger-than-life characters who figure in it. Edgar Allan Poe was at the time a young short story writer living in Richmond, Virginia. He was the editor of the Southern Literary Messenger, literary magazine. And 2 months earlier, in June of 1835, he had published a story called Hans Fall, A Tale, that imagined a balloon trip to the moon that was full of all kinds of scientific details. Poe himself, like Locke, was an astronomy buff. He was very interested in astronomy. A lot of people don't know that. And he had recently read an astronomy textbook, more or less, by none other than Sir John Herschel. And that had inspired him to write this story imagining a trip to the moon. And then the hero lands on the moon and encounters, you know, these lunarians on the surface of the moon. So Poe published this story and was shocked to discover 2 months later the Sun series. Well, you know, Poe was this incredibly vain, competitive guy, and he was convinced that the Sun had plagiarized his idea for their own series, and he was irate at the success of the Sun series compared to the, you know, relative obscurity of his own story.
Mm-hmm.
He spent years railing against the Sun series, trying to show all of the scientific errors that were in it. And 9 years later, as I alluded to earlier, when he moved to New York City, his very first order of business, the very first day that he arrived in the city, was to march over to the Sun offices on Nassau Street and plant his own hoax in the pages of the Sun to prove once and for all his superiority as a hoaxer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's pretty remarkable, and I guess typical of him. He obviously was thinking about it for some years.
He did think about it for a long, long time. It really bedeviled him for a long time.
That's right.
Yep.
So tell us how P.T. Barnum enters the fray.
Barnum, too. Yeah, Barnum was another young guy. These guys were all very young. They were all in their 20s. Locke was 35. He was about the oldest of the crew. Barnum, I think, was 25. He had arrived in the city the very same month, August of 1835, this amazing month, from rural Connecticut, from Bethel, Connecticut. He was a would-be showman. He'd always wanted to be a showman. And he had with him his first promotion, a woman named Joyce Heth, an African-American woman, an elderly woman, a slave, actually, from Virginia, who he claimed was 161 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, but was apparently the former nursemaid of George Washington when he was, you know, in the cradle. And Barnum plastered the city with, you know, promotional bills about this woman, and he displayed her at a place called Niblo's Garden, which was an entertainment mm-hmm. spot in New York. You know, he laid her out on a velvet couch, and New Yorkers swarmed to come see her, and, you know, the female Methuselah, as Barnum described her, you know, this incredibly wrinkled woman, paralyzed in both of her legs, blind, mm-hmm. And listened to her tell her tales of, you know, the young George Washington, and she told the story of the cherry tree, which in her memory was a pear tree, this was the promotion that really established Barnum in the public mind as a showman. And amazingly enough, the hoax, for of course it was a hoax, would eventually be exposed by none other than Richard Adams Locke in The Sun.
Yeah, no, that's quite a remarkable story. Let me ask you a couple of questions about the man-bats. You said earlier in the pre-interview they get a lot of attention, and I can understand why. Because they reminded me of two things. One was, and I'm sure you've heard this before, the flying monkeys in The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, right.
Have people mentioned that?
You know, actually not. That's funny.
But don't they, though? Because they're simian, you know?
Yeah,
you say that.
I know
simian.
Exactly what you mean.
Yeah, I'm like, somebody...
I always was freaked out by that scene in the movie.
Of course. I mean, those things are weird.
Yeah, really scary.
Yeah, those things are totally scary. And then the other thing, of course, is the Weekly World News Bat Boy. That's probably been mentioned a lot. Are there any relations between these things, or do they just sort of... do they just emanate from the popular consciousness and make their way?
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, I certainly haven't seen any indication that you know, the Weekly World News Bat Boy was in any way inspired by the Sun series. I think that, you know, it's sort of you know, just kind of in the public consciousness, and you know, when you think about, you know, who's going to be living on the moon, well, It's not that difficult to imagine bats living on the moon. You know, of course, in the 20th century, there was the War of the Worlds, the Orson Welles story, which or a radio show, rather, based on an H.G. Wells story, that was really kind of, you know, the equivalent in its time of the Sun hoax in its time. The difference, of course, was that the Wells story imagined an invasion of Martians on Earth, and of course it led to all kinds of tragic consequences, real life consequences, you know, people killing themselves and so forth. Whereas in Locke's time, people were absolutely delighted by this. They were really delighted to imagine that there was this peaceable kingdom up on Earth's closest neighbor, you know, because it confirmed for them what they already believed, which is that the moon was inhabited, that God, you know, that we weren't alone in the universe, that God had given us a populated universe.
Yeah. I tell you one thing that these hoaxes remind me of, and that is, you know, I studied the 16th and 17th century as a kind of profession. That's what I'm licensed to do. And, you know, there weren't really newspapers then, but there were various kinds of pamphlets that were given out. I guess they could be called proto-newspapers. But they always dealt in what were at the time called wonders. These were your two-headed calves and your Virgin Marys appearing in, you know, loaves of bread and that kind of thing. And they were the constant fare in these sorts of publications, and they sold like hotcakes. And you know, some of them were astronomical, actually, as well, now that I think about it. But it seems to me that there's something in the human spirit that wants to be informed about improbable and marvelous things.
Oh, I think that's absolutely right.
Yeah, that we really enjoy that stuff.
I think so. I think there's a sense of wonder. There's a sense that life can be grander than we had ever suspected it could be. And I think Locke keyed in on that. I think that Locke played to that with this, you know, these wondrous descriptions. I mean, you know, part of the, you know, the incredible power of the series was the amazingly detailed descriptions that Locke gave of the lunar landscape and the various creatures that he saw. I mean, you know, lush, lyrical, beautiful descriptions. You can't help but fall in love with this world, you know, that he created on the moon.
And they're somehow a little bit more exciting when we think when we actually lie to ourselves and think that they might be true. I mean, because you find the same lush descriptions in an Edgar Allan Poe story, which is obviously fiction, but there's something more titillating about the fact that it might be true, that it actually might exist in some sense. I know that one thing that I'm reminded of is, again, this tendency to want to kind of fool ourselves in this way is if you watch the History Channel, and that's just the History Channel, and we're supposed to be, you know, cold, hard empiricists here, but they have lots of shows about the paranormal the History Channel, which by the on my license, it says that we're not supposed to truck in that sort of stuff. But they must have different licenses at the History Channel because they have obviously learned
They have TV licenses.
They have TV licenses, and they've learned that this stuff, you know, basically it's this paranormal stuff and Nazis. Those are the two things you get on the History Channel.
But
it really is there's something, you know, deep in our soul that really wants to believe that there's something beyond what we see and feel and taste and hear. You know, we want wonder of some sort.
Well, it's a religious impulse at heart. You know, I mean, I think that's part of, you know, why people want to believe in God. You know, they want to believe that there's something magical, that there's something greater, you know, greater than they are, that there's something, you know, wondrous. There's something magical in the world.
It's funny you mention that because I know that. And you know, the debate, the discussion that we're having right now about what the wonderful looks like and how we could come to know it, has been obviously going on for centuries and centuries and you know, literally thousands of years. And I know that I was raised in a Lutheran tradition, and one thing that's clear in Lutheranism is Luther just gave up on trying to describe it. He just said, it is there, but we can't know anything about it. And so really, he was kind of making the point that you're making. He was saying, yes, we need this thing. We need to believe there's something beyond what we see, but we can't know anything about it, which, you know, is kind of it makes for boring music. I'll tell you that.
Well, you know, it's interesting because the astronomers of the time actually spent some time trying to imagine what these creatures actually looked like. You know, you did find some speculation in the astronomical literature at that time, you know, suggesting that the residents of Jupiter would have enormous eyeballs to compensate for the dimness of the light of the sun. And one of my favorites is Thomas Dick, this very popular Scottish astronomical writer of the time, kind of the Carl Sagan of his time, suggested that the inhabitants of comets were a race of astronomers because they had such a clear view of the universe that they made their way through the universe. These are delightful.
Yeah, no, they really are delightful, and I think that there's something in just cold hard fact that we find cold and hard, mm-hmm. and it just isn't satisfying enough for us. I will watch these shows on the paranormal, on the History Channel, or whatever it is, and just feel kind of dirty afterwards. But I really am very interested in it. You know, or they'll have one on the Shroud of Turin, or I don't know what it is. You know, some Kabbalistic, you know, literature that is lost, or you know, something that's obviously fiction of some sort. Actually, I was remembering this was like 3 or 4 years ago. They claimed they found the tomb of Jesus, Jacob. I guess it was Jesus' brother, supposedly. And I looked at it, and I remember I was working at the Atlantic at the time, and I sort of looked at the guy at the cubicle across from me, and I says, "The historian in me absolutely knows this is a hoax, but I really want to see this." And I was dead right. It was totally a hoax. It was totally a hoax. I said, "I know this is a hoax," and you know, but I really kind of wanted to believe. That they had found that stuff, you know, biblical archaeology and that kind of stuff, you know, find these things. And it's that impulse in it is really extraordinarily deep. And I mean, I think you do a good job of, you know, it is, I want to say it's almost a mass hysteria, but it isn't really mass. I feel it very personally, mm-hmm. that I want to, you know, I want to find these things out. And, you know, finding out that there's water on Mars just doesn't do the trick for me. I don't know about you, but I'm just like, okay, that's great. But I just doesn't, you know, that doesn't float my boat. I want little green. I'm reminded of what so a friend of mine said after seeing the design for the space shuttle. This was many years ago. He said, "I want a goddamn rocket ship. I don't want that.
I want a rocket ship, man. That insect-looking creature.
Yeah, I don't want. Yeah, right. Exactly. I want something that's pointy and flat. You know, like in the science fiction movies. So you know, I think that your book does a terrific job of kind of bringing that out. And again, you know, you're in the checkout stand at the 7-Eleven or whatever, and there's the Weekly World News with something absolutely fantastic on it, and I'm picking that thing up.
Well, a lot of that goes back to the sun in the 1830s, you know, both for good or bad. You know, a lot of the good aspects of tabloid journalism, you know, it goes back to the sun, and some of the not so good aspects goes back to the sun as well.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things about the free press is you either get all of it or none of it. That's been my impression, having studied places that tried to have some of it. They ended up having none of it. Yeah. So anyway, Matthew, I want to thank you very much for being on the show today. I really appreciated it. It's absolutely terrific book. I should tell our listeners that we've been talking to Matthew Goodman, and the book is called The Sun and the Moon, The Remarkable True Account of Hoaxers, Showmen, Dueling Journalists, and Lunar Man-Bats in 19th Century New York. And I want to close with our traditional final question and ask you what you're working on now.
Well, I am just beginning work on a new project about which I'm going to say not that much, except that it's another story about New York in the 19th century, another story about something that is little known but I think has a good deal of historical importance, and it's set in the 1850s, so a couple of decades after this.
And you're not going to tell us anything about it? It's a secret.
I think it's even really too early to.
Okay, good.
All right. To get into that.
Yeah, that's great. Well, anyway, thanks very much for being on the show. Really appreciate it. And when that book is done, we will talk to you about it. Okay.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much. It was really fun.
All right. Take care now. Bye bye.
Okay.
You've been listening to an interview with Matthew Goodman, the author of The Sun and the Moon, The Remarkable True Account of Hoaxers, Showmen, Dueling Journalists, and Lunar Man Bats in 19th Century New York. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History, and I hope you have a great week.